Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Yves Alain Bois, who is professor of art history at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and before that at Harvard and Johns Hopkins. He is the author of numerous foundational texts that have reshaped the way we see modern art, from Matisse and Mondrian to Robert Ryman and Richard Serra, and to mention only two of the most recent texts, the catalogue raisonné of Ellsworth Kelly's paintings and sculpture, as well as that of Matisse's paintings in the Barnes Foundation. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I wanted to start by asking about your perspective on art history. You had studied in France, but then you have worked for many years in the United States, and I wonder how you would characterize the discipline of art history here in the U.S. from a French or an international perspective?
Well, one of the reasons I came to America is because it has changed, I think, a bit, was that art history in France was completely dormant. It was a sleepy discipline with a few people doing interesting things, but which were completely ostracized by the establishment.
Yeah.
So you had a few individuals and you had the Ecole des Etudes where people were, Hubert Damisch, you know, were doing interesting things. But for the most part, the discipline was controlled by a mafia of, you know, grand old men who only wanted to have people doing exactly what they were doing, which is catalogue raisonné of mediocre 17th century French painter. That was it.
Yeah.
And there were some interesting things going in the medieval field, but not in art history per se. There were historians of medieval period who decided to study art. Yeah. They were not trained as art historians.
Yeah.
That basically was the thing.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very traditional, I call that not art history, but philately, attributions, all these kind of things which have to be done, but to consider that what art history is only on this mode was, for me, I was not interested.
Yeah.
And I found it boring. And it was also extremely chauvinistic. Nothing was translated by authors of German or English or whatever. It was it was French.
Yeah.
And the only thing that you were asked to study was 17th century French. That's it.
So
I said bye-bye to that way.
In the introduction to your book, Painting as Model, you wrote about resisting blackmail, the need to avoid having one's thinking deformed or pressured by some kind of external agenda. I wondered if you would still have the same views about method and about critical method, or would you write that introduction the same way today?
It's a good thing that you ask, actually, because this book that is now, well, almost 30 years old, was finally translated into French, or published in French, this past summer. And it's my fault if it was not until then. It's because I actually kind of wanted to redistribute the text in different other ways. And so I'm the one who just said, no, please don't publish it. But finally I said, yes, okay, fine, let's publish it. And the publisher wanted me to update the preface.
Uh-huh.
And I tried and I couldn't.
Oh.
So, because I realized it really is something that was written in one particular moment. And in a way, even though I don't consider myself as important there, but in a way it's a kind of historical document of the period.
Right.
And so instead I made a postface, which was a talk that I gave in a kind of symposium at the University of Nanterre about the humanities, in which I'd been asked bizarrely to come and speak about the state of American art history. I don't know exactly why they asked me, but and in there I speak about the history of this period where my preface had been written, which is this, very, very active moment of culture wars, really, in the early 90s, and late 80s, early 90s. And the difference today is that, in many, many ways, people who were cast as enemies don't feel that way anymore. There was this gigantic clamp of the social art history and the and the formalist of which I was supposed to be a part. And so as a formalist, you were this old fart doing totally reactionary work.
Right.
And, that was, It's not the, nothing. Yeah. Nobody thinks of that anymore. You have Tim Clark doing incredibly elaborate formal analysis of you know, I don't know, Veronese or whatever, and you have, you know, so-called formalists like myself digging deep into the context. So it's it's completely the parameters have disappeared, and also. And there's a very strong return to, you know, has been for a while, to the objects per se and all that. There is a less, I think, you know, far less reliance on so-called theory as this kind of buoy, you know.
Right.
And there are new things. There's this interesting material turn in art historical studies. There's something which I find very new and very... interesting, really, that has developed in the past, let's say, 10, 15 years, which is a dialogue between art historians and conservators that used to be two completely parallel universe, had never had any connection.
Yeah.
And now there is. I mean, the conservators have learned that it's very good to have a little bit of art history before you start repairing a painting or a sculpture.
Yeah.
And the artists have learned that it's very good to know the way things are made before you start babbling about it. So it's a very different situation than it was when I arrived in America. Very different.
Yeah. It seems like a better situation.
It is. I think that artistry in America is in a good shape, really.
You've also been an editor of the journal October for some years, which is one of the most important journals in this field. Do you think that the mainstream of art history has come closer to the approaches shown in this journal than when October was founded? Because would you say that when the journal began, it was more outside the establishment, say, than today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, what the establishment in art history in America exists, you know, still exists, but it doesn't have a lot of voice at the moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was basically the equivalent of my French philatelists.
Right.
They are very, you know, very, they are maybe not dominating in terms of voice, but they are probably still very important in some statistics. So amount of people doing, you know, this kind of, you know, boring stuff, frankly, and some of it has to be done, no doubt, but it shouldn't be all. The one thing that had been against this notion of very, very limited conception of what history is was iconology,
and
was,
right? You know,
and so Panofsky was for decades the big figure in art history and had a lot of imitators. But there was only this. There was only this possibility. If you want to do something else than pure philately,
right?
What October did is say, no, that's enough. We have to look at other disciplines. We have to look at, you know, other theories. We have to take advantage of all the advances made in literary criticism in all that. And the other enemy of the traditional and of iconology was the social art history.
Yeah.
So there were the two poles that resisted.
Right.
The kind of limiting the fact that the other path, the new art historical path, was only Panofsky, and for decades. So the social art history and what October did, which is basically import in the field of art studies, discourse of, you know, philosophy and structuralist and post-structuralist thought, and so what's called the French theory,
right.
as a kind of, you know, kind of abusive crumping of many things that are actually quite different. But certainly now, you know, I think that a lot of the abuse of this fascination for theory has gone, and people now, you know, realize it's. Not everything has to be taken for granted,
right.
But there's a lot of things that have to be gained from mastering this discourse. And I think, it's less exotic.
Yeah.
And I think it's good, the fact that it's less exotic, because it has less an effect of fashion, and people, you know, if they want to use the tools given to them by those. You know, theoretical discourse, they do it better than they did before.
Speaking again of October, I also wanted to to ask you about the textbook Art Since 1900, which is a two volumes, and now I guess in its third edition, a very important survey of modern art. And on the one hand, someone could say, well, this textbook is from the October School or this October Journal because of the writers. But I also thought, you know, there are obviously various. There are several authors, you and your colleagues, and there must be also disagreements about, you know, about priorities, for example, on Duchamp or Joseph Beuys or Warhol and so forth. So I was curious if, especially as you get to the most recent contemporary material, I was curious if you could speak about maybe disagreements or if there are sort of unresolved questions about the priorities for contemporary art or divergences among your co-authors.
Well, you know, people have always this idea that October is this kind of united front.
Right.
It's not true at all. I mean, they should come to our editorial meetings, which are just one on Sunday. It's not at all like that. It's a lot of different voices. And in the book, which is now five authors, at first it was four, now it's five, You know, as I often speak about when I present to friends Benjamin Buchloh, I say it's a friend I like to disagree most with. You know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that Benjamin Buchloh, Alfonso Rosalind Krauss, and now David Joslit say. Not at all, even though Joslit is a student of mine.
Yeah.
You know, there's very different voices. And I suppose that with regard to contemporary production, I'm not in great, you know, great sympathy with a lot of things that have been picked by some of my colleagues. So, but I think that's what makes this textbook useful in some way.
Yeah.
Although it might be a little confusing for some for some students who would want to have everything kind of buttered up and totally in a completely seamless frame, but I wouldn't be able to do that, and I don't think any of my colleagues would be able to do that. So yes, there are disagreements, and sometimes even about, do we really need to have something on that art movement? I don't have examples now because it happened several times where all of us, the five authors, really truly despise one particular thing,
right.
And we feel it's a phenomenon, so we have to speak about it.
Thinking more about kind of contemporary, let's say the last 20 or 30 years, again, in Painting as Model, you referred to the task of mourning in relation to painting and the question of this status of painting and the concept of the death of painting, which I think has been kind of debated almost continuously for many years and maybe still today. I wanted to ask about your thoughts on painting as a medium at this moment and how you would characterize the most recent decades in painting.
I think that the death of painting is a kind of trope that comes back, you know. And my take was in that essay was that it's every generation has to invent a new way to kill painting. Because, you know, the death of painting is announced basically periodically every 15 years or something with great fanfare. I mean, you know, I recently wrote a fairly long essay on Rebecca Quaitman, who is a painter. And, you know, and we discussed about this, you know, what does it mean today to be a painter? And she actually paints more and more. I mean, at first she was using a lot of silk screening, but now she actually paints a lot. And she said, you know, you were right. As long as in taste for the, you know, as long as there is appetite for handiwork and the smell of turpentine, they'll be painters. You know, because it's a kind of, so I don't know, like for Maya Shapiro in the 50s, painting and the particular gesture it's a brilliant piece called Liberating Quality of the Avant-Garde, something. Piece appeared in 1957 in the same issue of Art News as Duchamp's Creative Act piece. I think it's called The Liberating Quality of the Avant-Garde.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting text in which basically he explains that painting, especially gestural painting, is like the last refuge against pure commodification and transformation of everyone into a robot and whatever. And I have the feeling that the enemy today is not the machine, of course, because that's already lost, but it's the kind of the painting wants to have a dialogue, not necessarily a negation, but a dialogue with the digital world.
Yeah.
Because that's the world that is ours now.
Yeah.
So, and it's, and I think someone like Rebecca, and but there are others, are trying to find ways to, so it's not, the, it's not the it's not the death of painting, it's not the resuscitation of painting, but it's a, hey, we still have something in our sleeve to try to, you know, prevent a brave new world.
Yeah.
That I think it's not the last refuge, but one weapon.
I wanted to continue by asking you a little bit about Henri Matisse, and Professor Bois' lecture tonight at the National Sculpture Center is entitled "What's with the Bamboo Stick? Matisse's Late Drawing Practice." A wonderful title. So Matisse made these paintings that address music and dance, and you show that the phenomenology of bodily experience, physical experience, not just visual experience, is very essential for Matisse. Could you talk about this bodily experience, whether music or dance or rhythm, and how Matisse puts that into his painting?
Well, yeah, it's a very difficult, complex question, yeah, to unpack, so I won't do it here. But I think that what you're referring to is there's something that happens in Matisse in relationship to having to paint a gigantic commission for Barnes,
yeah,
in his commission in 1931 and all that. And he just suddenly, you know, there's something, the idea that the body and the real, the material support of a work, the size and the scale, all that is related to a body. That's something that he got very early on.
Mm-hmm.
When he, and I mentioned that in the lecture, when he realized he didn't need to do a cartoon, it was impossible to square up a small drawing to make a big one. You just have to do everything at the right scale, the scale, yeah, 1:1. So that involves the body, the reality.
Yeah.
It's against the notion of a projection, to have an image in your mind that you project, which, yeah, was a Renaissance idea. so he had this idea very, very early on, but I think that there's a change, a leap that happens in the 30s, in the early 30s, when he's working for the Barnes Dance, which is this gigantic product. And, you know, and he had not done anything like that, and he had never done any big mural or whatever. So he begins to, he has a lot of trouble getting into this surface. And when he gets it, it's totally through a complete identification of his body with as if he was dancing. Because, yeah, he was, the topic was dance, and you have these bizarre sketches, which are not preparatory for the painting really, but are like gestures that he does very quickly while looking, or not even looking, while being in the same room as a dancer that he has hired, and we ask to do some gymnastic and things like that, and this is this kind of bodily identification with the theme is not something that you have, or with the material also, it's not something that you have really anywhere before Matisse at that time. I don't think so. And I think it's, in some ways, you could say that some of the abstract expressionists later picked up on some of that of Matisse, but not needing any more theme. They didn't even dance anymore. That was not the issue. But the sort of, you know, material identification of the body. I mean, when you look at the films of Hans Nemeth, of Pollock painting, right, he's dancing, basically.
Yeah.
It's what he's doing. And the gesture is just, you know, it's a completely elegant thing in which the droplets of on the canvas can be said to be the it's like a photographic, you know, it's equivalent of a photographic trace,
right,
of a gestural, but a bodily gesture.
I think that's very interesting, and the way that the later generations of artists pick it up. And I wanted to ask you about on the one hand, with this sort of bodily experience, there's the sequence of artists, Matisse, and then the later artists, but then also philosophers like Bergson, whom Matisse read, and so forth, and then Husserl or other philosophers. What kind of awareness do these different artists have of the philosophy of phenomenology, yeah. or is it just picked up directly from the other artists?
Yeah, I don't think that Matisse had, but just Bergson certainly. We know yeah. that we know he read Bergson, and he also read Proust. Proust is, I think that he read Bergson, but he was not a professional. He had no right. philosophical education, yeah. really. But he was a very smart and attentive man, and someone must have told him, well, there's something in Proust that, and in Proust there is. And as in Bergson, which is something that is picked up by Walter Benjamin on the text on Proust, there is this notion of the muscular involuntary memory, mm-hmm. and of kind of automatism that is not the automatism of the surrealist, always and unconscious and the sex drive.
Right.
Not, it's not. It's pure, muscular memory.
Right.
That you have that in Bergson, and Matisse was obviously fascinated by that, and he even alluded to it. And I'm going to mention in the talk. he, at the time with his elaborating his method of drawing as a kind of automatic thing, which is in the 30s. It's also the moment where he speaks about Manet mm-hmm. as the first painter who conceived of the task of the painter as a reflex.
Mm-hmm.
So just this idea of let the bodily, control.
Right.
And he starts elaborating this his method of drawing, of which he became very, very proud. And so proud that during first of all, as soon as he felt that he had matured, he had a publication in the Cahiers d'Art of a special issue of his new drawings, which are these line drawings. And during the war in 1942, he pays himself a whole publication of a book called Thèmes et Variations, of which he gives copy to every single museum in France and every single art school, because he felt it was a method that would benefit the youth. And the method is this: he has two types of drawings. The drawings which he called the conscious drawings, and when he means conscious is that when he draws them, he's aware of what he's doing. He can talk with the sitter when it's a portrait. He's like of this world. He's like in reality and all that. And then, and that's why he makes a lot of charcoal usually drawing, and he can edit. He kind of erase. He kind of starts again. He kind of when he feels that he has his subject in his head, as he says, or I would say in his hands, then comes a moment of the unconscious drawing.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like a trance, it's like exactly like a trance. And he says, yeah. If someone knocks at the door, if the telephone rings, I lose contact with my drawing.
Yeah.
And this is completely automatic.
Yeah.
And he says, that's what he wants. He often compares his this thing with the notion of an acrobat. He feels like an acrobat has to do a lot of exercise. But then, when he's on the high wire artist, when he's on the wire, if he thinks of what he's doing, he's going to fall.
Yeah,
it has to become completely automatic.
Yeah.
And he basically already in the mid 30s says that he wants to do that in painting, but he doesn't know if he'll have the time to do it until he dies.
Yeah.
And then he has this big health crisis in 1941, and then he thought he was going to die. He doesn't die, and he says, "Oh, I have all this extra life now,
yeah.
so I can try," and. And I think that he's very confident that he finally succeeded in a very late moment of his painting, which is 46-48 in Vence, where Kimball is just around the same time, but just
right.
slightly before. And when you look at those paintings that he made then, which are those big interiors, most famous is the interior with the Egyptian curtain at the Phillips collection, but they are like 15 of them.
Yeah.
When you look at those paintings, the white space between the plane, there's only a little white intervals between planes of color. It's completely white.
Yeah.
And so you think the painting had been in one session.
Yeah.
But not at all. It was always painted and erased and painted and erased until it became completely automatic.
Wow.
And I asked Lydia Deletoskaya, who was assistant at the time, how come it's so white?
Yeah.
Because race painting, with turpentine gets kind of dirty.
Yeah.
And she said I was a very good eraser.
Wow, amazing. This is the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. Oscar Olson is our engineer, and Eva Lambois' visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UT Dallas School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.